For hundreds of years, the planet Mars has been the subject of heated controversy among scientists.
Falcon Heavy is configured for flight.
Pago Delta nominal.
5, 4, 3, 2. Main engine start. 0 and liftoff of the Delta rocket with Opportunity.
When you look at a planet as one little tiny dot in space, it really isn't representative of what's going on the planet.
It's a stretch goal that is so audacious.
We are one world, and that we are more connected than we give ourselves credit for a lot of the time.
Hello, welcome to We Martians. I'm Jake Robbins. With the new decadal survey dropping last month, the talk of the town is the top flagship mission recommendation, a Uranus orbiter and probe. It's been 36 years since Voyager 2 flew by Uranus on a brisk visit, snapping some photos and heading on to the next destination. And since that time, we've learned a lot about the solar system, from the terrestrial planets to the gas giants, the asteroid belt, and the Kuiper belt. And it's high time we spent some time exploring the last class of planet left to study in our neck of the woods, the ice giants. Dr. Amy Simon from NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center was a science lead on the Uranus Orbiter and Probe Concept Study, the document which the Decadal Survey used to make its recommendation. She joins us today to talk about how the mission might work, why exploring Uranus is so important, and what comes next. All right, so we're here today with Dr. Amy Simon from NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center. Amy, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
I'm very excited to have you on today. We're going to talk about a planet I have literally no experience with. So I'm excited to learn some really brand new things today. Before we talk about Uranus and this cool mission concept, though, I want to learn just a little bit about you. So can you tell the listeners sort of what your day job is and how you got into studying planets?
Sure, absolutely. So my interest in planetary science really started when I was a kid. And it was partially because of the Voyager missions. So obviously we didn't have the internet and, you know, all the great things we have today, but seeing those images come down on the nightly news of these exotic planets, you know, Saturn, Uranus, Neptune, it was kind of eye-opening for me, I think. But it was also the era where the space shuttle program was just kicking off. So, you know, Sally Ride was the first American woman in space, and I was going to be the first American woman on Mars. That was the plan. Hasn't happened yet, obviously.
Still time.
Yeah. Still time. But I moved on to college and graduate school, and my first project was studying Jupiter with the Hubble Space Telescope right before the comet Shoemaker-Levy 9 impacts. And right then and there, it was outer planets from there on out. So studying the atmospheres of Jupiter first, but then later Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune.
Cool. That's awesome. Yeah. So we have passions on opposite sides of the asteroid belts. I'll say it's like that for us. Okay. So that's kind of where I want to start is what the heck are these planets? And so, yeah, the context here is we just had this decadal survey come out. There was this great new recommendation for a Uranus orbiter, which you participated on the study for as a science lead, I think is what you were, your job was there. I know so little about these places that I kind of want to start with that. So the first question I have is, I hear this term ice giant a lot, and I think maybe sometimes I group all the outer planets as to just like big gas balls, and I don't really understand what the difference is there. So what do we mean by ice giant versus gas giant? What makes sort of, you know, Uranus and Neptune their own little group?
Right, right. That's a fair question. And I think the term ice giant is relatively new. Mm-hmm. So certainly when I grew up, we had four giant planets. We called them all gas giants, and that was kind of the end of the picture. But I think what's happened is as we've learned more and more about them, what we've really found out is that Jupiter and Saturn are a different class of planet than Uranus and Neptune. And if you look at their atmospheric composition, they're very different. Their size, they're very different, and so on. So Jupiter and Saturn are primarily hydrogen and helium, as we all learned in grade school. And so we call those the gas giants, the two of them. And then when we look at Uranus and Neptune, they have a higher proportion of ices in their atmosphere. So they're still all fluid planets, even slushy if you want. They're not solid ice balls. But just to distinguish the two from each other, we call them ice giants. And I think there's a lot of debate even in the planetary community because it's not a great term. You know, it is a little misleading, but it's primarily to distinguish them from each other.
Yeah. And when you say ice is, like, are we just talking literally like water ice in the atmosphere?
Water ice, ammonia ice, even methane ice, hydrogen sulfide ice. Basically, it's cold enough out there, all sorts of things start to freeze out.
Okay, cool. So if we're looking at Uranus as a place to study, what are the really important questions we can answer there? What makes this planet kind of a special place to visit?
I think if we start kind of back at the 50,000 foot level, why do we even want to study these planets at all? There's two big questions. And the first one is, how did our solar system form? And how did our planets get to where they are today? And then the second one is this difference in planetary class. And so tackling the first one, I think, you know, the very old theory is our planets formed exactly where they are. They just swooped around, picked up all the protosolar nebula material, and that was it. But then we found all these extrasolar planets, and we had giant planets very close to their parent star. And that makes no sense because there's not enough material for them to have formed there. So it became apparent that a lot of these planets migrate inwards. And if there were other planets in, you know, closer, they would have gotten swept up along the way. Well, now that's a problem for our solar system. Why didn't that happen? You know, why didn't Jupiter come in, sweep away Mars and the Earth? And the thought is that having four of these giant planets is basically what helps stabilize our solar system. So Jupiter did start to migrate inwards, and Saturn, Uranus, Neptune kind of pulled it back out, possibly even some position swapping going on in there. And so that's one of the things we want to learn is, where were these planets when they formed? And the only way you can do that is to sample their atmospheres. And then that second part of the equation is this ice giant, gas giant thing. When we look at these extrasolar planets and we start to plot various functions of like their gravity and their density, looking at their mass and radius, essentially, they fall into two branches of planets, the first of which Jupiter and Saturn sit on. And then the other one is this branch that the Uranus and Neptune fit on. So we have these super Neptune-ish sized planets, whether they're cold or hot doesn't matter. They're a different size scale than Jupiter and Saturn. So by studying, you know, the least studied planets in our solar system, we're learning about all these exoplanets as well.
Huh. You know, there's sometimes you come across like a question in science that like really like pulls on your heart. Like you're just like, it's like a question that just really makes you like open your imagination. And the idea of the structure of our solar system, of having these like planets in the inner solar system, and then this kind of barrier, and then these gas giants out here, having the question of whether that's like normal or if that's an exception is like one of those questions for me, where it's just like, wow, so these ice giants pulled Jupiter away and that left this special place intact, you know, in the middle. Like that's a really cool question to me. I don't know how you feel about that, but that really kind of excites me.
It is, you know, origins was not something that I think was my initial passion either. But I think as we've studied these planets and we've had missions out to some of them, you get this idea that everything is so much more dynamic than that flat picture we had in a textbook, right? Things are moving around, they're always evolving, they're changing. And it kind of fits in with this whole model of how things formed as well.
Yeah, yeah. Uranus is pretty special in that its rotation axis is pretty weird. Can you talk about sort of what opportunities that presents? Like it's basically on its side rolling through the solar system rather than spinning like Earth does.
Right. It's very strange. And it's both a blessing and a curse at the same time. you know, it has extremely long seasons because one pole is bathed in sunlight for half the year and then the other one. So that's very unique. We don't know how this happened. This comes back to this whole crazy, how did everything form in the first place? On the other hand, it has a ring system. It has a regular satellite system that had to have formed when it formed. So whatever caused it to tilt over, you know, was very early on in its formation. But on the other hand, that allows us to approach it in a polar orbit. And, you know, the holy grail of our space missions is always trying to get into polar orbit so we can figure out the internal gravity field and the magnetic field. So that's a good aspect. But then, of course, to get around to our satellites and explore our satellites, we then need to get into an equatorial phase. So there's a lot of challenges, I think, that come along with this. But it's also pretty interesting because it makes it such a weird planet.
Yeah. And I guess the magnetosphere is really interesting, too, because the poles of the planet don't really line up with the rotation axis, and that makes a I was looking at some pictures, like some diagrams of sort of the tail of the magnetosphere, and it makes some really crazy patterns. Is that sort of going to be part of any mission that we end up sending there?
Oh, definitely. I mean, if you look at the magnetospheres of Earth and Jupiter, they're pretty regular, North Pole, South Pole, maybe a little wiggles here and there. Saturn is almost perfectly flat, North Pole, South Pole. But when you look at the two ice giants, especially, their magnetospheres are all over the place. It's not just a nice dipole magnet like we're used to. There's kind of blobs of magnetic field all over the place. When it interacts with the sun, the solar wind, you do get these crazy, you know, interactions. And when we dry it out, it looks like a pile of spaghetti. It's just a mess. But yeah, I think any mission that's going to be a big focus is to understand that magnetosphere. And I think one of the problems we have with the Voyager mission, Voyager 2, is it was only a flyby. Mm-hmm. And that's really not good for understanding a complex system like this, because you're getting one snapshot as you pass through it.
Yeah, yeah. And what about the moon? This seems like an overlooked, I'm sure you aren't overlooking it, but at least in the coverage of you know, we're going to explore Uranus, the moons to me feel like it's like a whole bunch of bonus planets that you get to explore. What about Uranus's moons are intriguing to you, and what can we learn from them?
It's got quite an interesting moon system, really. We don't have a single giant moon. We don't have a Titan. But you do have some really bizarre smaller moons, and they seem to have young surfaces. And so if you look at them, Ariel and Miranda, they have scarps and all sorts of strange stress features on them, or ridges. We have Umbriel, has a little icy polar cap, maybe. Hard to say. We didn't get a good look with Voyager 2 again. Titania might have some internal heat. So there's a possibility we could have ocean worlds, like we have at Europa and Enceladus. There's some evidence that Mab, which is a very small moon, it's kind of in one of these sparse rings of Uranus, might be like Enceladus, might be contributing to that ring. So there could be quite a lot going on in these places that are absolutely frigid cold, which is really intriguing for understanding how geology and geophysics works, because it's, again, very different material properties than what you would have if it was warm.
Yeah, yeah. So the question I also see a lot is why Uranus and not Neptune? Because we've got two planets here that seem to offer a lot of the same kind of opportunity. And we've, you know, done the same single flyby of both of them. So tell me a little bit about why you think Uranus should be the one we go to.
Yeah, you know, I think scientists are split on which one it should be, because depending what they find more interesting. But they're both intriguing. They both have rings, satellites, magnetospheres. So the same broad disciplinary science and interdisciplinary, you can do it either one. The big difference is how hard it is to get there. And so, you know, if you're going to go all the way out there, you really want a comprehensive mission. You don't want to bare bones and do a single little flyby again. You really want that comprehensive orbiter. You want an atmospheric probe. And when you factor in the fact that Neptune is just so much farther away, it is really hard to get a mission out there. And so we're not quite there on the combination of launch vehicle capabilities and propulsion and power systems to be able to realistically get to Neptune with a large mission. And so that is what makes Uranus, I think, stand out for this decadal survey, is that we could fly that now. We have all the technology we need to get that mission off the ground today.
Okay, great. So let's talk about that mission then. I think that's maybe the natural next step here. So what I really want to start with is so this decadal survey is a complex process, you know, that this goes through, and there's all these studies that come in, and then this recommendation drops. And I think sometimes it kind of sounds like, you know, NASA's going, then it's like set in stone. They're ready. They're putting a team together. But that's not quite how this works yet. So can you maybe describe the role of the study you made as well as the decadal survey together, and sort of what stage we're at in getting a Uranus mission off the ground?
Sure. So the decadal survey happens every 10 years. And the purpose of it is not to come up with the exact plan of what NASA will do. It really is to define the science priorities for the decade. Because of how we do planetary science, and it is so exploration-based, you know, it tends to veer into the missions as well, just naturally, because it has to. So what we do is we convene panels of scientists in each discipline area that will go through their own disciplines, questions, and targets and what they want to do and recommend those up to a steering group. And the steering group is the one that makes the final decision on the priorities as they look across the entire portfolio of what NASA could do. So part of that is that we have to commission these mission studies, because it's great for us to say we want, a flagship mission to Chiron or someplace. But if we don't have any realistic engineering behind it and we don't have any costing behind it, it's not obvious if you can do it. Mm-hmm. And so prior to the decadal study, there were some studies that were commissioned by NASA. And then there was also a competition where people could propose ideas, what they wanted to study. And all of that fed into the decadal survey as study reports, along with white papers on other ideas that maybe didn't get studied. And as we go through that priority process, the panels themselves said, there's another area we haven't studied. We should do that one as well. And so those studies tend to be shorter, but those are, again, as we're starting to look across the science questions. And so this particular study happened during the decadal survey. It was recommended by several of the panels to make sure that we studied this point as well. And so all of those missions, regardless of where they came from, are then independently evaluated by technical experts to make sure that we aren't just, patting ourselves on the back and believing things that aren't true. And they will then put their own, check on realism on these missions. And that all gets fed into the decisions that get made in the end.
Okay, cool. Yeah, and I think this the Uranus orbiter and probe has some foundation in some previous studies. I think I almost remember maybe it was a few years ago where there was like a big hit the news. There was like both a Uranus and a Neptune concept that like really, was released or something like that. And I remember reading about that and thinking that it was similar to this. I don't know if you were part of that as well.
Yeah, actually, I was. So the last decadal survey had the Uranus mission as the number three mission. So that was the flagship to start after Europa Clipper. But for the same reasons, we also looked at Neptune there, and it was still no easier 10 years ago than it is now. So landed in the same place. But once the decadal survey was over, that mission was clearly not going to start very soon. So as a community, we pushed that we really need to go back through, refine the science, maybe do some mission studies. And what happened was NASA commissioned this study to look at Uranus or Neptune, flybys, orbiters, every possible architecture you could think of. What is the best thing to do? So it wasn't a detailed single design study, but it looked across all that trade space to see what was feasible and what is the science you really want to do.
Cool. Okay. All right. So tell us about this mission then. So, it's an orbiter and a probe. I know that much. We come in, tell us about the launch, the cruise, the tour. How do we execute this? What's the concept of operations?
Sure. So of course, when we do these missions, we want to find the most cost-effective way to do them. And for Uranus or Neptune even, getting to Jupiter, having a Jupiter gravity assist really makes everything so much easier. So this particular study that we did, the most effective option is to launch in about 2031, 2032, because that keeps us lined up to get to Jupiter and get that gravity assist out to Uranus. So if we do that, it takes about 12 years to get out there, which is not too bad, all things told.
Yeah.
Could be better, could be worse. And then we would enter in on this polar trajectory, get into orbit, drop the probe, and then basically do flybys of Titania to start to shift that orbit around to move from polar towards equatorial so we can do this satellite tour. So it's a really comprehensive mission from that perspective. It does include that probe science that we can't get any other way, but it still allows us to get to all the satellites and study the rings and magnetosphere as well.
Okay. So yeah. So, and you get to kind of do, I guess that's pretty diverse in terms of things you can explore, because you've got polar, you've got equatorial, you've got moons, you've got atmosphere. So that's probably, it seems like it's optimized for higher order discoveries, right? Which would make sense for a planet we've never really spent any time at.
Yeah, absolutely. It's meant to be broad. It, it's a lot of different disciplines. So even the payload tends to be very broad, because again, you're trying to do so much and get those high order questions answered.
Yeah. Tell us about the instruments. What kind of Well, everyone's going to want to know about the cameras, but what other kind of instruments do we have on this?
Right. So keeping in mind that this is a notional payload just for the study, of course, it'll change. But the idea was, of course, to have the imaging system, both narrow angle for high resolution and wide angle to get, you know, big, broad pictures. Obviously, a magnetometer and a lot of fields and particles instruments to understand the high energy particles in the magnetosphere, all the stuff that's floating around. Again, that very complex system, but then spectrometers. So there was a visible and near infrared spectrometer. That tends to be good for looking at composition of the surfaces and in the atmosphere. Mm-hmm. And there's a broad suite of other instruments you could include. So again, these were just examples, but trying to cover the biggest wavelength range you can. So everything from near ultraviolet up through thermal infrared, so you can get temperatures as well. And then those in-situ fields and particles instruments on the orbiter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's interesting to me, like the difference of a payload like that, because if you compare it to a mission like a very specialized mission, so say something like NASA's InSight or what else? I guess even MAVEN would be a good choice for that, where it's like it's going to location specifically for like really going after like a few key kinds of measurements and what those payloads look like versus something like this, which is just like go and look at Uranus and tell us everything.
Exactly.
It's very interesting to see kind of reminds me, I guess, of Cassini, right? It's probably a lot of similarities to what Cassini did.
Yeah, it's quite similar to Cassini, I would say probably most like Cassini rather than Galileo. Galileo was even a little bit smaller, I think. But.
Right. Yeah. And then the probe. So this is the second part of the orbiter, which is going to enter the atmosphere. Can you tell us a little bit about what that looks like? You know, in a normal terrestrial planet, I can imagine entering the atmosphere and landing, but this is not that. So can you maybe describe what that, I don't even know, does it just fly in until it's crushed, I guess, is what
the... Essentially, more or less, yeah. So the entry probes would be very similar to what we did on Galileo for Jupiter. It is literally, you know, a spherical probe. It has a heat shield that it would drop off once it got through the upper atmosphere. And then the instruments are all about sampling that atmosphere. So mass spectrometers, things like that, tunable laser spectrometers, things that can tell us the exact composition, including isotopic ratios and the holy grail of everything, those noble gases. So we want to know how much helium there is, neon, you know, argon, krypton, things that we just cannot detect from orbit, because those particular molecules and those isotopes are very critical to where Uranus formed in the solar system. And so we have to get those measurements to figure out how old it is and where it was.
Hmm. Okay. And so does it just float down on a parachute then? Is that how? Yeah.
So initially when it's falling in, it's literally falling. That heat shield is to absorb the heat, and then it'll release a drogue chute essentially to slow it down before a main chute opens. And then I wouldn't say it floats. It's probably still falling pretty fast down into the atmosphere. It gets down to about 5 or 10 bars. So there's two, I think, complications with an atmospheric probe in particular on the giant planets. The first is the pressure. Eventually everything gets crushed. But the second one is communication. So you have to be able to talk back to your orbiter. And because it is flying by, you only get, you know, a limited window where it can stay in communication. So that's kind of a limitation usually on the probes.
Okay. Is there concern with like wind? I don't know what the weather would be like on Uranus, but I can imagine something like this getting tossed around pretty good on a big planet like that.
Yep, it's very windy. And that is another measurement that we'd want to get, is that wind profile as you descend. And they do that actually by measuring the Doppler shift of an ultra-stable oscillator. So basically the signal that is pinging the orbiter, they can measure its Doppler shift as it descends. And from that, you can get the wind speeds, which is really cool. But one thing we found on Galileo and we anticipated is as you're coming down on a parachute, even though it's a somewhat round shape, you can imagine it spins and it pendulums back and forth and you get all sorts of funny things. But but the instruments are designed to be able to measure those sorts of motions as well. So you can take that out.
Interesting. Okay, cool. Yeah, I mean, I'm trying to remember the last time we did something like that would have been, I guess you could count Cassini itself diving in to do stuff, maybe one case of it, but was Galileo must have been the last. Maybe Huygens, would you count that, I guess, as a similar style of probe?
It's somewhat similar, except, of course, it's going down to a solid surface. So
So
it's a different atmospheric profile. But yeah, the Galileo probe is the only time we've sent one into a giant planet atmosphere.
Yeah. I read in the report that there was a decision one idea would be to deploy the probe as you're entering orbit, which I guess saves you some delta V because you don't need to slow the probe down for orbit. But you made a decision in this study, at least in this notional idea, not to do that. Can you talk a little bit about why?
Yeah, that's actually an interesting point. And all the previous studies that we did on this, whether it was the last decadal or before this decadal, during this decadal, everybody always wants to get rid of the probe so you don't have to carry that mass into orbit. You know, as you say, it's less fuel to burn to break into orbit just because you have less mass. But it turns out it's not really that much different. And the problem we had is that communication link, you want to be as close to the planet as you can when you're doing your probe communication. Well, that kind of interferes with the orbit insertion burn. And so all those previous studies, within an hour, you had the probe entry, the communication, and that orbit insertion burn. So you have multiple critical events really close together and often on the far side of the planet. So Earth doesn't even have communication on what's going on. It's a little scary. There's a lot of risk involved. And so the decision was to see, is there any way to do this where we can separate those out from each other? So you don't have all these critical events happening at the same time. And really the only way to do that is to take the probe into orbit with you and then release it. And because in the end, it really made very little difference in the propulsion and the delta V, it really did work out. That is the best thing to do. And it really just separates everything, makes it nice and clean. So it's a much safer way to do it.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I guess the probe's probably a pretty small percentage of the total mass of the whole vehicle, right?
Exactly.
Do you get savings on not having to make the heat shield as powerful then, I guess? Because all the delta V you spent getting into orbit is no longer needed to burn off in the atmosphere, right?
Right. It makes the entry a little bit easier as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay, cool. Awesome. So I'd like to know a little bit about why you think this study got such high marks. There was the whole Neptune thing, I guess. But overall, I mean, this looks like a pretty sound proposal. And I'm just curious to hear your perspective on why you think it got such high marks.
You know, I think even coming out of the last decadal survey, it was already pretty highly ranked. And I think what's really become apparent is this has such broad science. It has something for people who study atmospheres, interiors, magnetospheres, rings, moons. The strong connection to exoplanets, the strong connection to the heliophysics community because of that interaction between the magnetosphere and the solar wind. So it's something for everybody. Mm-hmm. I think the other thing is that it's just, you know, its time has come. The ice giants have become more important because of these extrasolar planets, but we also haven't been there since 1986. You know, we were flying 1970s technology when we went out to Uranus for the last time. So there's been a lot of water under the bridge. We can really do things now we could not do then, which is just going to make that science even more valuable.
The report mentioned that the technology was a big part about this, and you kind of hinted at this, that all this is possible right now. So in terms of launch vehicle, power, communications, all the kind of engineering bits that go into this, what would be the most challenging engineering problem in this proposal, in your opinion?
I think the timing, obviously trying to get to a 2031 launch. Means it needs to start pretty soon.
The scheduling, the human part. Yeah.
These things don't happen quickly, no matter what we'd like. So that's the first one. And that's really just a budgetary issue. So that does come down to the priorities that get set for the NASA budget. And then the other one is not a technology issue, but again, somewhat of a budgetary issue, is that we would have to get our RTGs ready. Mm-hmm. So the plutonium has to be available, and all of that technology is there. It's just funding. So
yeah. One of our listeners, Nolan, wanted to know about those RTGs because I know they had there was a while where they were like not making very much of it, and then that was a big problem. But it seems like they've started it back up, and things are looking a lot better now, right?
That's right. It's been restarted, so it's just a matter of how fast they produce it and which version of the RTGs that we can use for the mission, what's available at the time. So we're not assuming anything super advanced. We don't need the dynamic RTGs that were in development for a while. We can use the standard ones. So it's just a matter of which ones are available.
Cool. And then the last question on the design here, this is from a listener, Brad, and it was kind of an insightful question. I kind of like it. So how do you design a proposal like this with so many, I guess you can call them like unknown unknowns, right? So in a planet that we have not ever been to, besides this quick flyby one of my whole lifetimes ago, how do you capitalize on the surprises that may come? What kind of flexibility do you design into the system to account for that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that's actually the beauty of most of our missions is we go to these places with a set of questions we want answered, and inevitably we were totally wrong. There was some other spectacular thing we hadn't thought of. But that is, I think, the value of having this very broad instrument suite. You can look all over the place and you'll have the cameras, you'll have the spectrometers. No matter what you find, just like Cassini, you'll be able to adjust real time and say, nope, we want extra observations of the planet or a certain moon with certain instruments. And I think, you know, that's really the value of having the big mission. When you have a very narrow mission where you're trying to very specifically do one thing, as we talked about earlier, you don't have that flexibility to be able to just change your plans, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I think it is just having this broad, high-level mission is inherently more flexible to start with.
Yeah, yeah. And then it's just up to us to pivot, I guess, right?
Exactly.
Cool. Okay. So what comes next for this? And, we've got the proposal in, the Decadal likes it, they recommend it to NASA. What is the next step between now and, orbital insertion?
Right. So, it's not a proposal, to be clear. It's a mission concept. So
sure.
What will happen next is NASA will take all these recommendations and decide how they want to prioritize their budget for the next bunch of years and whether or not this gets a new start. And so that's out of our hands entirely. But the science community itself will now be thinking about what science investigations they do want to do, what instruments they do want to propose, should this get its start in the next year or two. So we wait, but we will keep the excitement up, of course, and keep working towards making the mission happen.
Yeah, yeah. And I guess NASA's, they have their response for the Decadal coming out in the summer. They wanted to have 90 days to look at it, I guess. So that might be their next clue as to how they feel about it. And then it's up to Congress, I guess.
Right. And, this of course, is not the only thing in the Decadal. There's recommendations across all the disciplines, all the programs. So there's a lot for them to digest and figure out how to shoehorn in.
Yeah. Okay. One last question, and it's very important. How do we deal with the jokes? Do you have a personal policy on this?
I think we need a really cool mission name really fast.
Yeah.
So we can stop calling it the Uranus Orbiter and Probe. But beyond that, I got this question on several interviews actually with a TV station in New Zealand, and they took it all in good fun. And I think most scientists do too. If that's what it takes to make it exciting, That's fine with me.
Excellent. Okay. Yeah. I saw a tweet from Emily Lochtewall who said, we just need to lean into it. And I'm going to take that advice. That's
exactly.
That's my advice for that. Awesome. Well, Amy, this is a really great conversation. I'm excited for this mission. I really hope that it becomes real. If the listeners want to learn more about you or the proposal or anything like that, is there anywhere you can point them to on the internet?
So the National Academies, if you just look up Planetary Science Decadal, you will find the full report. And it actually has a link in the report to the mission study itself. I won't bother to try to read off a long URL to everybody, but you can find it pretty easily if you just Google Planetary Science Decadal, and everything will be in there.
Okay, awesome. Well, Amy, thanks again for spending some time with us. Very cool.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
That's it for this week, Martians. Huge thanks to Amy for sharing some of the details behind this study. It's super interesting to learn more about this planet that we know so little about. And if you too want to lean into the jokes a little bit about this mission, I'm here to help. I put together a fun design for a t-shirt called Probe Uranus that's now available in our shop. You can show the whole world just how badly you too want to explore the dark mysteries of Uranus. But if you can't quite bring yourself to wear the shirt, you can also get it in a coffee mug as well. You can find that at shop.wemartians.com. Have a great week, and at Aries, Martians. We Martians is an independent, listener-funded podcast created by me, Jake Robbins, on planet Earth. You can reach us at info@wemartians.com or on Twitter @we_Martians.